truth, our truth, the truth that was seeded in the earth when each of us arrived here, formed in the image of God. Cultivating that truth, I believe, is the authentic vocation of every human being. Chapter 3. When Way Closes, Way Will Open. By the time I began my sabbatical at Pendle Hill, the year that stretched into a decade, I had been in Washington, D.C. for 5 years, growing more fearful every day that I was living a life not my own. I was 35 years old and had a Ph.D. and decent references, so finding a new job would have been no great problem, not in that place and time. But I wanted more than a job. I wanted deeper congruence between my inner and outer life. I had worked in Washington as both a community organizer and a professor, an activist and an intellectual, without feeling at home in either of those worlds. If you buy the scurrilous notion that those who can do and those who can't teach, which I may have half believed at the time, mired as I was in a slough of despond, you will understand why it felt like I had exhausted all possible vocations. If I were ever to discover a new direction, I thought, it would be at Pendle Hill, a community rooted in prayer, study, and a vision of human possibility. But when I arrived and started sharing my vocational quandary, people responded with a traditional Quaker counsel that, despite their good intentions, left me even more discouraged. "Have faith," they said, "and way will open." I have faith, I thought to myself. What I don't have is time to wait for way to open. I'm approaching middle age at warp speed, and I have yet to find a vocational path that feels right. The only way that's opened so far is the wrong way. After a few months of deepening frustration, I took my troubles to an older Quaker woman well known for her thoughtfulness and candor. "Ruth," I said, "people keep telling me that way will open. Well, I sit in the silence, I pray, I listen for my calling, but way is not opening. I've been trying to find my vocation for a long time, and I still don't have the foggiest idea of what I'm meant to do. Way may open for other people, but it's sure not opening for me." Ruth's reply was a model of Quaker plain speaking. "I'm a birthright friend," she said somberly, "and in 60-plus years of living, way has never opened in front of me." She paused, and I started sinking into despair. Was this wise woman telling me that the Quaker concept of God's guidance was a hoax? Then she spoke again, this time with a grin. "But a lot of way has closed behind me, and that's had the same guiding effect." I laughed with her, laughed loud and long, the kind of laughter that comes when a simple truth exposes your heart for the needlessly neurotic mess it has become. Ruth's honesty gave me a new way to look at my vocational journey, and my experience has long since confirmed the lesson she taught me that day. There is as much guidance in what does not and cannot happen in my life as there is in what can and does. Maybe more. Like many middle-class Americans, especially those who are white and male, I was raised in a subculture that insisted I could do anything I wanted to do, be anything I wanted to be, if I were willing to make the effort. The message was that both the universe and I were without limits, given enough energy and commitment on my part. God made things that way, and all I had to do was to get with the program. My troubles began, of course, when I started to slam into my limitations, especially in the form of failure. I can still touch the shame I felt when, in the summer before I started graduate school at Berkeley, I experienced my first serious comeuppance. I was fired from my research assistantship in sociology. Having been a golden boy through grade school, high school, and college, I was devastated by this sudden turn of fate. Not only was my source of summer income gone, but my entire graduate career seemed in jeopardy. The professor I had come to Berkeley to study with was the director of the project from which I had been fired. My sense of identity and my concept of the universe crumbled around my feet for the first but not last time. What had happened to my limitless self in a limitless world? The culture I was raised in suggested an answer. I had not worked hard enough at my job to keep it, let alone succeed. I regret to report that there is some truth in that answer. Another research assistant and I had made frequent, disrespectful, and apparently audible jokes about the project on which we were working. We goofed off so much that our supervisor got bent out of shape, as perhaps did some of the data we were punching into IBM counter-sorter cards. My associate and I had rationalized our behavior with a juvenile notion that the project was a joke long before we started making jokes about it. Today, 30 years later, my inner adolescent, which is less wise but more tenacious than the infamous inner child, still clings to the belief that we may well have been right. Whatever merit this twisted rationale may have, it is true that I did not work hard enough to keep that job, and so I lost it. Learning our limits. But that truth does not go deep enough, not if I am to discover the meaning of way closing behind me. I was fired because that job had little or nothing to do with who I am, with my true nature and gifts, with what I care and do not care about. My resort to adolescent rebellion reflected that simple fact. I apologize belatedly for my immaturity, for the grief I gave my supervisor, and for whatever damage I may have done to the data. None of that is to my credit. But I was laughing to keep myself sane. Perhaps the research I was doing was what a good sociologist ought to do, but it felt meaningless to me, and I felt fraudulent doing it. Those feelings were harbingers of things to come, things that eventually led me out of the profession altogether. Obviously, I should have dealt with my feelings more directly and exercised more self-control. Either I should have quit that job under my own steam, or settled in and done the work properly. But sometimes the shoulds do not work because the life one is living runs crosswise to the grain of one's soul. At that time in my life, I had no feeling for the grain of my soul and no sense of which way was crosswise. Not knowing what was driving me, I behaved with blind but blissful unconsciousness, and reality responded by giving me a big and hard-to-take clue about who I am. Way closed behind me. Neither that job nor any job like it was in the cards for me, given the hand I was dealt at birth. That may sound like sinfully fatalistic thinking, or worse, a self-serving excuse, but I believe it embodies a simple, healthy, and life-giving truth about vocation. Each of us arrives here with a nature, which means both limits and potentials. We can learn as much about our nature by running into our limits as by experiencing our potentials. That, I think, is what Ruth and life were trying to teach me. It would be nice if our limits did not reveal themselves in such embarrassing ways as getting fired from a job. But if you are like me and don't readily admit your limits, embarrassment may be the only way to get your attention. I go on full alert only when I am blocked or get derailed or flat out fail. Then, finally, I may be forced to face my nature and find out whether I can make something of both my gifts and my limitations. It is important to distinguish between two kinds of limitations: those that come with selfhood, and those that are imposed by people or political forces hell-bent on keeping us in our place. I do not ask everyone who gets fired to conclude that it was the work of a gracious God offering clues to one's true vocation. Sometimes it is the work of a pathological boss or a corporate culture, getting rid of people whose propensity for truth-telling threatens the status quo. Sometimes it is the result of an economic system that robs the poor of their jobs so that the rich can get richer still. Like everything else in the spiritual life, getting guidance from way closing requires thoughtful discernment. Our problem as Americans, at least among my race and gender, is that we resist the very idea of limits, regarding limits of all sorts as temporary and regrettable impositions on our lives. Our national myth is about the endless defiance of limits, opening the western frontier, breaking the speed of sound, dropping people on the moon, discovering cyberspace at the very moment when we have filled old-fashioned space with so much junk that we can barely move. We refuse to take no for an answer. Part of me treasures the hopefulness of this American legacy. But when I consistently refuse to take no for an answer, I miss the vital clues to my identity that arise when way closes, and I am more likely both to exceed my limits and to do harm to others in the process. A few years ago, I was introduced at a conference as a recovering sociologist. The line got a good laugh, but it also snapped me back to my ignominious failure in the summer before I began graduate school. My soul needed to recover from the misfit between sociology and itself. But before that could happen, my ego needed to deal with its shame. I had to get through graduate school and prove, however briefly, that I could succeed as a professor of sociology, even though that path took me directly into vocational despair. The despair that took me from teaching sociology at Georgetown to the community at Pendle Hill contained a call to vocational integrity. Had I not followed my despair, and had Ruth not helped me understand it, I might have continued to pursue a work that was not mine to do, causing further harm to myself, to the people and projects with which I worked, and to a profession that is well worth doing by those who are called to do it. The ecology of a life. Despite the American myth, I cannot be or do whatever I desire, a truism to be sure, but a truism we often defy. Our created natures make us like organisms in an ecosystem. There are some roles and relationships in which we thrive and others in which we wither and die. It is clear, for example, as I enter my 60s, that I cannot and will not be president of the United States, even though I grew up surrounded by a rhetoric that said that anyone, read any white male, could rise to that lofty role. I no longer grieve this particular limitation, for I cannot imagine a crueler fate for someone with my nature than to be president of anything, let alone a nation-state. Still, encouraged by the myth of the limitless self, I spent many years trying to deny this ecological truth. Here is a story to prove it. During my tenure as dean at Pendle Hill, I was offered the opportunity to become the president of a small educational institution. I had visited the campus, spoken with trustees, administrators, faculty, and students, and had been told that if I wanted it, the job was most likely mine. Vexed as I was about vocation, I was quite certain that this was the job for me. So, as is the custom in the Quaker community, I called on half a dozen trusted friends to help me discern my vocation by means of a clearness committee, a process in which the group refrains from giving you advice, but spends 3 hours asking you honest, open questions to help you discover your own inner truth. Looking back, of course, it is clear that my real intent in convening this group was not to discern anything, but to brag about being offered a job I had already decided to accept. For a while, the questions were easy, at least for a dreamer like me. What is your vision for this institution? What is its mission in the larger society? How would you change the curriculum? How would you handle decision-making? What about dealing with conflict? Halfway into the process, someone asked a question that sounded easier yet, but turned out to be very hard. What would you like most about being a president? The simplicity of that question loosed me from my head and lowered me into my heart. I remember pondering for at least a full minute before I could respond. Then, very softly and tentatively, I started to speak. Well, I would not like having to give up my writing and my teaching. I would not like the politics of the presidency, never knowing who your real friends are. I would not like having to glad-hand people I do not respect simply because they have money. I would not like... Gently but firmly, the person who had posed the question interrupted me. May I remind you that I asked what you would most like? I responded impatiently, yes, yes, I'm working my way toward an answer. Then I resumed my sullen but honest litany. I would not like having to give up my summer vacations. I would not like having to wear a suit and tie all the time. I would not like. Once again, the questioner called me back to the original question, but this time I felt compelled to give the only honest answer I possessed. An answer that came from the very bottom of my barrel, an answer that appalled even me as I spoke it. Well, said I in the smallest voice I possess, I guess what I'd like most is getting my picture in the paper with the word president under it. I was sitting with seasoned Quakers, who knew that though my answer was laughable, my mortal soul was clearly at stake. They did not laugh at all, but went into a long and serious silence, a silence in which I could only sweat and inwardly groan. Finally, my questioner broke the silence with a question that cracked all of us up, and cracked me open. "Parker," he said, "can you think of an easier way to get your picture in the paper?" By then it was obvious, even to me, that my desire to be president had much more to do with my ego than with the ecology of my life. So obvious that when the Clearness Committee ended, I called the school and withdrew my name from consideration. Had I taken that job, it would have been very bad for me and a disaster for the school. The ecological theory of life, the theory of limits, works wonderfully well with situations like this. My nature makes me unfit to be president of anything, and therefore, if I stay true to what I know about myself, I will die having avoided a fate that for me would be worse than death. But what happens to the theory of limits when what I want to do is not to get my picture in the paper, but to meet some human need? What happens to that theory when my vocational motive is virtuous, not egotistical? To be a teacher from whom students can learn, or a counselor who helps people find themselves, or an activist who sets injustice right. Unfortunately, the theory of limits can work as powerfully in these cases as it does with my presidential prospects. There are some things I ought to do or be that are simply beyond my reach. If I try to be or do something noble that has nothing to do with who I am, I may look good to others and to myself for a while, but the fact that I am exceeding my limits will eventually have consequences. I will distort myself, the other, and our relationship, and may end up doing more damage than if I had never set out to do this particular good. When I try to do something that is not in my nature or the nature of the relationship, way will close behind me. Here is one example of what I mean. Over the years, I have met people who have made a very human claim on me by making known their need to be loved. For a long time, my response was instant and reflexive, born of the oughts I had absorbed. Of course you need to be loved, everyone does, and I love you. It took me a long time to understand that although everyone needs to be loved, I cannot be the source of that gift to everyone who asks me for it. There are some relations in which I am capable of love and others in which I am not. To pretend otherwise, to put out promissory notes I am unable to honor, is to damage my own integrity and that of the person in need, all in the name of love. Here is another example of violating one's nature in the name of nobility, an example that shows the larger dangers of false love. Years ago, I heard Dorothy Day speak. Founder of the Catholic Worker Movement, her long-term commitment to living among the poor on New York's Lower East Side, not just serving them but sharing their condition, had made her one of my heroes. So it came as a great shock when, in the middle of her talk, I heard her start to ruminate about the ungrateful poor. I did not understand how such a dismissive phrase could come from the lips of a saint until it hit me with the force of a Zen koan. Dorothy Day was saying, "Do not give to the poor expecting to get their gratitude so that you can feel good about yourself. If you do, your giving will be thin and short-lived, and that is not what the poor need. It will only impoverish them further. Give only if you have something you must give. Give only if you are someone for whom giving is its own reward. When I give something I do not possess, I give a false and dangerous gift, a gift that looks like love but is in reality loveless, a gift given more from my need to prove myself than from the other's need to be cared for. That kind of giving is not only loveless but faithless, based on the arrogant and mistaken notion that God has no way of channeling love to the other except through me. Yes, we are created in and for community, to be there in love for one another. But community cuts both ways. When we reach the limits of our own capacity to love, community means trusting that someone else will be available to the person in need. One sign that I am violating my own nature in the name of nobility is a condition called burnout. Though usually regarded as the result of trying to give too much, burnout, in my experience, results from trying to give what I do not possess, the ultimate in giving too little. Burnout is a state of emptiness, to be sure, but it does not result from giving all I have. It merely reveals the nothingness from which I was trying to give in the first place. May Sarton, in her poem, Now I Become Myself, uses images from the natural world to describe a different kind of giving, grounded in a different way of being, a way that results not in burnout, but in fecundity and abundance. As slowly as the ripening fruit, fertile, detached, and always spent, falls but does not exhaust the root. When the gift I give to the other is integral to my own nature, when it comes from a place of organic reality within me, it will renew itself and me even as I give it away. Only when I give something that does not grow within me do I deplete myself and harm the other as well. For only harm can come from a gift that is forced, inorganic, unreal. The God of Reality. The God I know does not ask us to conform to some abstract norm for the ideal self. God asks us only to honor our created nature, which means our limits as well as potentials. When we fail to do so, reality happens, God happens, and way closes behind us. The God I was told about in church, and still hear about from time to time, runs about like an anxious schoolmaster measuring people's behavior with a moral yardstick. But the God I know is the source of reality rather than morality, the source of what is rather than what ought to be. This does not mean that God has nothing to do with morality. Morality and its consequences are built into the God-given structure of reality itself. Moral norms are not something we have to stretch for, and moral consequences are not something we have to wait for. They are right here, right now, waiting for us to honor or violate the nature of self, other, world. The attempt to live by the reality of our own nature, which means our limits as well as our potentials, is a profoundly moral regimen. John Middleton Murray put this truth into words that challenge the conventional concept of goodness to its core. For a good man to realize that it is better to be whole than to be good is to enter on a straight and narrow path compared to which his previous rectitude was flowery license. The God whom I know dwells quietly in the root system of the very nature of things. This is the God who, when asked by Moses for a name, responded, I am who I am, Exodus 3:14. An answer that has less to do with the moral rules for which Moses made God famous than with elemental isness and selfhood. If, as I believe, we are all made in God's image, we could all give the same answer when asked who we are. I am who I am. One dwells with God by being faithful to one's nature. One crosses God by trying to be something one is not. Reality, including one's own, is divine, to be not defied but honored. Lest this theologizing become too ethereal, I want to give an example of how honoring one's created nature can support morality in practice. I sometimes lead workshops for teachers who want to become better at their craft. At a certain point, I ask them to write brief descriptions of two recent moments in the classroom. A moment when things went so well that you knew you were born to be a teacher, and a moment when things went so poorly that you wished you had never been born. Then we get into small groups to learn more about our own natures through the two cases. First, I ask people to help each other identify the gifts that they possess that made the good moment possible. It is an affirming experience to see our gifts at work in a real-life situation, and it often takes the eyes of others to help us see. Our strongest gifts are usually those we are barely aware of possessing. They are part of our God-given nature, with us from the moment we drew first breath, and we are no more conscious of having them than we are of breathing. Then we turn to the second case. Having been bathed with praise in the first case, people now expect to be subjected to analysis, critique, and a variety of fixes. If I had been in your shoes, I would have, or Next time you are in a situation like that, why don't you? But I asked them to avoid that approach. I asked them instead to help each other see how limitations and liabilities are the flip side of our gifts, how a particular weakness is the inevitable trade-off for a particular strength. We will become better teachers not by trying to fill the potholes in our souls, but by knowing them so well that we can avoid falling into them. My gift as a teacher is the ability to dance with my students, to teach and learn with them through dialogue and interaction. When my students are willing to dance with me, the result can be a thing of beauty. When they refuse to dance, when my gift is denied, things start to become messy. I get hurt and angry. I resent the students whom I blame for my plight, and I start treating them defensively in ways that make the dance even less likely to happen. But when I understand this liability as a trade-off for my strengths, something new and liberating arises within me. I no longer want to have my liability fixed by learning how to dance solo, for example, when no one wants to dance with me, for to do that would be to compromise or even destroy my gift. Instead, I want to learn how to respond more gracefully to students who refuse to dance, not projecting my limitation on them, but embracing it as part of myself. I will never be a good teacher for students who insist on remaining wallflowers throughout their careers. That is simply one of my many limits. But perhaps I can develop enough self-understanding to keep inviting the wallflowers onto the floor, holding open the possibility that some of them might hear the music, accept the invitation, and join me in the dance of teaching and learning. Turning around to discover the world. When Wei closes behind us, it is tempting to regard it simply as the result of some strategic error. Had I been smarter or stronger, that door would not have slammed shut. So if I redouble my efforts, I may be able to batter it down. But that is a dangerous temptation. When I resist Wei closing rather than taking guidance from it, I may be ignoring the limitations inherent in my nature, which dishonors true self no less than ignoring the potentials I received as birthright gifts. As Ruth taught me, there is as much guidance in Wei that closes behind us as there is in Wei that opens ahead of us. The opening may reveal our potentials, while the closing may reveal our limits. Two sides of the same coin, the coin called identity. In the spiritual domain, identity is coin of the realm, and we can learn much about our identity by examining either side of the coin. As often happens on the spiritual journey, we have arrived at the heart of a paradox. Each time a door closes, the rest of the world opens up. All we need to do is stop pounding on the door that just closed, turn around, which puts the door behind us, and welcome the largeness of life that now lies open to our souls. The door that closed kept us from entering a room, but what now lies before us is the rest of reality. That paradox takes me back to Pendle Hill and the moment when Ruth taught me the meaning of Wei closing. As I sat there fretting about the doors that had slammed in my face, I was sitting in the very place where my world would soon open wide. Had I been able to see my own future at that moment, I would have laughed even harder than I did when Ruth's words exposed my inner mess. My future had already arrived, and its name was Pendle Hill, the place where my year-long sabbatical stretched on for a decade, where I deepened my experiment with alternative education and started learning a new way to teach, where my struggle to understand myself and the world drew me into the writing that has become so central to my vocation. My anxiety about Wei not opening, the anxiety that kept me pounding on closed doors, almost prevented me from seeing the secret hidden in plain sight. I was already standing on the ground of my new life, ready to take the next step on my journey if only I would turn around and see the landscape that lay before me. If we are to live our lives fully and well, we must learn to embrace the opposites, to live in a creative tension between our limits and our potentials. We must honor our limitations in ways that do not distort our nature, and we must trust and use our gifts in ways that fulfill the potentials God gave us. We must take the no of the way that closes and find the guidance it has to offer. and take the yes of the way that opens and respond with the yes of our lives. Chapter 4. All the Way Down. A Personal Preface. Midway on our life's journey, I found myself in dark woods, the right road lost. To tell about those woods is hard, so tangled and rough and savage that thinking of it now, I feel the old fear stirring. Death is hardly more bitter. And yet, to treat the good I found there as well, I'll tell what I saw. From the Inferno of Dante, translated by Robert Pinsky. Midway in my life's journey, way closed again, this time with a ferocity that felt fatal. I found myself in the dark woods called clinical depression, a total eclipse of light and hope. But after I emerged from my sojourn in the dark and had given myself several years to absorb its meaning, I saw how pivotal that passage had been on my pilgrimage toward selfhood and vocation, though I recommend it to no one, and I do not need to, for it arrives unbidden in too many lives. Depression compelled me to find the river of life hidden beneath the ice. Still, I was unable to write about my depression for a very long time. What I learned and how I learned it remained raw to the touch. Then I was invited to contribute to a journal on the theme of the wounded healer in memory of Henri Nouwen, who was my mentor and my friend. If I were to honor Henri's life in a manner true to his spirit, I had no choice but to write about my own deepest wound. Henri himself spent time on the dark side of the moon, and he talked and wrote openly about it. But during the years when he and I saw a great deal of each other, I rarely spoke to him about my own darkness. Even in his gracious presence, I felt too ashamed. I am no longer ashamed, but I still find depression difficult to speak about because the experience is so unspeakable. Yet Henri's spirit continues to call me and many others to more openness and vulnerability, more shared humanity and mutual healing, even, and perhaps especially, when the subject is so difficult that words seem to fail. My only real fear about publishing these reflections is that someone may take the wrong counsel from them. Depression comes in many forms. Some are primarily genetic or biochemical and will respond only to drugs. Some are primarily situational and will respond only to inner work that leads to self-knowledge, choices, and change. Some lie in between. Though I needed medication for brief periods to stabilize my brain chemistry, my depression was largely situational. I will tell the truth about it as far as I am able. But what is true for me is not necessarily true for others. I am not writing a prescription. I am simply telling my story. If it illumines your story or the story of someone you care about, I will be grateful. If it helps you or someone you care about turn suffering into guidance for vocation, I will be more grateful still. The Mystery of Depression. Twice in my 40s, I spent endless months in the snake pit of the soul. Hour by hour, day by day, I wrestled with the desire to die, sometimes so feeble in my resistance that I practiced ways of doing myself in. I could feel nothing except the burden of my own life and the exhaustion, the apparent futility of trying to sustain it. I understand why some depressed people kill themselves. They need the rest. But I do not understand why others are able to find new life in the midst of a living death, though I am one of them. I can tell you what I did to survive and eventually to thrive, but I cannot tell you why I was able to do those things before it was too late. Because of my not knowing, perhaps I have learned something about the relation of depression to faith, as this story may illustrate. I once met a woman who had wrestled with depression for much of her adult life. Toward the end of a long and searching conversation, during which we talked about our shared Christian beliefs, she asked, in a voice full of misery, "Why do some people kill themselves, yet others get well?" I knew that her question came from her own struggle to stay alive, so I wanted to answer with care, but I could come up with only one response. "I have no idea. I really have no idea." After she left, I was haunted by regret, Couldn't I have found something more hopeful to say, even if it were not true? A few days later, she sent me a letter saying that of all the things we had talked about, the words that stayed with her were, "I have no idea." My response had given her an alternative to the cruel Christian explanations common in the church to which she belonged. The people who take their lives lack faith or good works or some other redeeming virtue that might move God to rescue them. My not knowing had freed her to stop judging herself for being depressed and to stop believing that God was judging her. As a result, her depression had lifted a bit. I take two lessons from that experience. First, it is important to speak one's truth to a depressed person. Had I offered wishful thinking, it would not have touched my visitor. In depression, the built-in bunk detector that we all possess is not only turned on, but is set on high. Second, depression demands that we reject simplistic answers, both religious and scientific, and learn to embrace mystery, something our culture resists. Mystery surrounds every deep experience of the human heart. The deeper we go into the heart's darkness or its light, the closer we get to the ultimate mystery of God. But our culture wants to turn mysteries into puzzles to be explained or problems to be solved, because maintaining the illusion that we can straighten things out makes us feel powerful. Yet mysteries never yield to solutions or fixes, and when we pretend that they do, life becomes not only more banal, but also more hopeless, because the fixes never work. Embracing the mystery of depression does not mean passivity or resignation. It means moving into a field of forces that seems alien, but is in fact one's deepest self. It means waiting, watching, listening, suffering, and gathering whatever self-knowledge one can, and then making choices based on that knowledge, no matter how difficult. One begins the slow walk back to health by choosing each day things that enliven one's selfhood and resisting things that do not. The knowledge I am talking about is not intellectual and analytical, but integrative and of the heart. And the choices that lead to wholeness are not pragmatic and calculated, intended to achieve some goal, but simply and profoundly expressive of personal truth. It is a demanding path, for which no school prepares us. I know. I had to walk that path a second time because what I learned about myself the first time frightened me. I rejected my own knowing and refused to make the choices it required, and the price was a second sojourn in hell. From the outside looking in, it is odd that some of my most vivid memories of depression involve the people who came to look in on me, since in the middle of the experience I was barely able to notice who was or was not there. Depression is the ultimate state of disconnection. It deprives one of the relatedness that is the lifeline of every living being. I do not like to speak ungratefully of my visitors. They all meant well, and they were among the few who did not avoid me altogether. But despite their good intentions, most of them acted like Job's comforters. The friends who came to Job in his misery and offered sympathy that led him deeper into despair. Some visitors, in an effort to cheer me up, would say, "It's a beautiful day. Why don't you go out and soak up some sunshine and look at the flowers? Surely that'll make you feel better." But that advice only made me more depressed. Intellectually, I knew that the day was beautiful, but I was unable to experience that beauty through my senses, to feel it in my body. Depression is the ultimate state of disconnection, not just between people, but between one's mind and one's feelings. To be reminded of that disconnection only deepened my despair. Other people came to me and said, "But you're such a good person, Parker. You teach and write so well, and you've helped so many people. Try to remember all the good you've done, and surely you'll feel better." That advice, too, left me more depressed, for it plunged me into the immense gap between my good persona and the bad person I then believed myself to be. When I heard those words, I thought, "One more person has been defrauded, has seen my image rather than my reality, and if people ever saw the real me, they would reject me in a flash." Depression is the ultimate state of disconnection. not only between people and between mind and heart, but between one's self-image and public mask. Then there were the visitors who began by saying, "I know exactly how you feel." Whatever comfort or counsel these people may have intended to speak, I heard nothing beyond their opening words, because I knew they were peddling a falsehood. No one can fully experience another person's mystery. Paradoxically, it was my friend's empathetic attempt to identify with me that made me feel even more isolated, because it was over-identification. Disconnection may be hell, but it is better than false connections. Having not only been comforted by friends, but having tried to comfort others in the same way, I think I understand what the syndrome is about: avoidance and denial. One of the hardest things we must do sometimes is to be present to another person's pain without trying to fix it, to simply stand respectfully at the edge of that person's mystery and misery. Standing there, we feel useless and powerless, which is exactly how a depressed person feels, and our unconscious need as Job's comforters is to reassure ourselves that we are not like the sad soul before us. In an effort to avoid those feelings, I give advice, which sets me, not you, free. If you take my advice, you may get well, and if you don't get well, I did the best I could. If you fail to take my advice, there is nothing more I can do. Either way, I get relief by distancing myself from you, guilt-free. Blessedly, there were several people, family and friends, who had the courage to stand with me in a simple and healing way. One of them was a friend named Bill, who, having asked my permission to do so, stopped by my home every afternoon, sat me down in a chair, knelt in front of me, removed my shoes and socks, and for half an hour simply massaged my feet. He found the one place in my body where I could still experience feeling and feel somewhat reconnected with the human race. Bill rarely spoke a word. When he did, he never gave advice, but simply mirrored my condition. He would say, "I can sense your struggle today," or, "It feels like you are getting stronger." I could not always respond, but his words were deeply helpful. They reassured me that I could still be seen by someone. Life-giving knowledge in the midst of an experience that makes one feel annihilated and invisible. It is impossible to put into words what my friend's ministry meant to me. Perhaps it is enough to say that I now have deep appreciation for the biblical stories of Jesus and the washing of feet. The poet Rainer Maria Rilke says, "Love consists in this, that two solitudes protect and border and salute each other." That is the kind of love my friend Bill offered. He never tried to invade my awful inwardness with false comfort or advice. He simply stood on its boundaries, modeling the respect for me and my journey, and the courage to let it be that I myself needed if I were to endure. This kind of love does not reflect the functional atheism we sometimes practice, saying pious words about God's presence in our lives, but believing, on the contrary, that nothing good is going to happen unless we make it happen. Rilke describes a kind of love that neither avoids nor invades the soul's suffering. It is a love in which we represent God's love to a suffering person, a God who does not fix us, but gives us strength by suffering with us. By standing respectfully and faithfully at the borders of another's solitude, we may mediate the love of God to a person who needs something deeper than any human being can give. Amazingly, I was offered an unmediated sign of that love when, in the middle of one sleepless night during my first depression, I heard a voice say, simply and clearly, "I love you, Parker." The words did not come audibly from without, but silently from within. And they could not have come from my ego, which was too consumed by self-hatred and despair to utter them. It was a moment of inexplicable grace, but so deep is the devastation of depression that I dismissed it. And yet that moment made its mark. I realized that my rejection of such a remarkable gift was a measure of how badly I needed help. From the inside looking out. Acknowledging my need for professional help was not easy. I had believed that going into therapy was a sign of weakness, and that weakness was bad. But once I got past that barrier, I ran into another one, Since professional has come to mean a person with a bag full of techniques and fixes, it is not always easy to find a professional who fulfills the original meaning of the word. A person grounded in a profession of faith, faith in the nature of ultimate reality, in the matrix of mercy in which our lives are embedded. I had abortive meetings with two psychiatrists whose reliance on drugs and whose dismissive attitude toward the inner life would have made me angry enough to get well simply to spite them had I not been terminally depressed. But finally, blessedly, I found a counselor who understood what was happening to me as I needed to understand it, as a spiritual journey. Of course, it was not the sort of spiritual journey I had hoped someday to take, not an upward climb into rarefied realms of light, not a mountaintop experience of God's presence. In fact, mine was a journey in the opposite direction, to an inner circle of hell and a face-to-face encounter with the monsters who live there. After hours of careful listening, my therapist offered an image that helped me eventually reclaim my life. "You seem to look upon depression as the hand of an enemy trying to crush you," he said. "Do you think you could see it instead as the hand of a friend, pressing you down to ground on which it is safe to stand?" Amid the assaults I was suffering, the suggestion that depression was my friend seemed impossibly romantic, even insulting. But something in me knew that down to the ground, was the direction of wholeness, thus allowing that image to begin its slow work of healing in me. I started to understand that I had been living an ungrounded life, living at an altitude that was inherently unsafe. The problem with living at high altitude is simple. When we slip, as we always do, we have a long, long way to fall, and the landing may well kill us. The grace of being pressed down to the ground is also simple. When we slip and fall, it is usually not fatal, and we can get back up. The altitude at which I was living had been achieved by at least four means. First, I had been trained as an intellectual not only to think, an activity I greatly value, but also to live largely in my head, the place in the human body farthest from the ground. Second, I had embraced a form of Christian faith devoted less to the experience of God than to abstractions about God, a fact that now baffles me. How did so many disembodied concepts emerge from a tradition whose central commitment is to the Word become flesh? Third, my altitude had been achieved by my ego, an inflated ego that led me to think more of myself than was warranted in order to mask my fear that I was less than I should have been. Finally, it had been achieved by my ethic, a distorted ethic that led me to live by images of who I ought to be or what I ought to do, rather than by insight into my own reality, into what was true and possible and life-giving for me. For a long time, the aughts had been the driving force in my life, and when I failed to live up to those aughts, I saw myself as a weak and faithless person. I never stopped to ask, how does such and such fit my God-given nature, or is such and such truly my gift and call? As a result, important parts of the life I was living were not mine to live, and thus were doomed to fail. Depression was indeed the hand of a friend trying to press me down to ground on which it was safe to stand, the ground of my own truth, my own nature, with its complex mix of limits and gifts, liabilities and assets, darkness and light. Eventually, I developed my own image of the befriending impulse behind my depression. Imagine that from early in my life, a friendly figure, standing a block away, was trying to get my attention by shouting my name, wanting to teach me some hard but healing truths about myself. But I, fearful of what I might hear, or arrogantly trying to live without help, or simply too busy with my ideas and ego and ethics to bother, ignored the shouts and walked away. So this figure, still with friendly intent, came closer and shouted more loudly. But I kept walking. Ever closer it came, close enough to tap me on the shoulder, but I walked on. Frustrated by my unresponsiveness, the figure threw stones at my back, then struck me with a stick, still wanting simply to get my attention. but despite the pain, I kept walking away. Over the years, the befriending intent of this figure never disappeared, but became obscured by the frustration caused by my refusal to turn around. Since shouts and taps, stones and sticks had failed to do the trick, there was only one thing left. Drop the nuclear bomb called depression on me, not with the intent to kill, but as a last-ditch effort to get me to turn and ask the simple question, "What do you want?" When I was finally able to make that turn and start to absorb and act on the self-knowledge that then became available to me, I began to get well. The figure calling to me all those years was, I believe, what Thomas Merton calls true self. This is not the ego self that wants to inflate us, or deflate us, another form of self-distortion. Not the intellectual self that wants to hover above the mess of life in clear but ungrounded ideas. Not the ethical self that wants to live by some abstract moral code. It is the self planted in us by the God who made us in God's own image. The self that wants nothing more or less than for us to be who we were created to be. True self is true friend. One ignores or rejects such friendship only at one's peril. The way to God is down. When I was finally able to turn around and ask, "What do you want?" the answer was clear. I want you to embrace this descent into hell as a journey toward selfhood and a journey toward God. I had always imagined God to be in the same general direction as everything else that I valued, up. I had failed to appreciate the meaning of some words that had intrigued me since I first heard them in seminary. Tillich's description of God as the ground of being. I had to be forced underground before I could understand that the way to God is not up, but down. The underground is a dangerous but potentially life-giving place to which depression takes us. A place where we come to understand that the self is not set apart or special or superior, but is a common mix of good and evil, darkness and light. A place where we can finally embrace the humanity we share with others. That is the best image I can offer, not only of the underground, but also of the field of forces surrounding the experience of God. Years ago, someone told me that humility is central to the spiritual life. That made sense to me. I was proud to think of myself as humble. But this person did not tell me that the path to humility, for some of us at least, goes through humiliation, where we are brought low, rendered powerless, stripped of pretenses and defenses, and left feeling fraudulent, empty, and useless. A humiliation that allows us to regrow our lives from the ground up, from the humus of common ground. The spiritual journey is full of paradoxes. One of them is that the humiliation that brings us down, down to the ground on which it is safe to stand and to fall, eventually takes us to a firmer and fuller sense of self. When people ask me how it felt to emerge from depression, I can give only one answer. I felt at home in my own skin, and at home on the face of the earth for the first time. Florida Scott Maxwell put it in terms more elegant than mine. You need only claim the events of your life to make yourself yours. When you truly possess all you have been and done, you are fierce with reality. I now know myself to be a person of weakness and strength, liability and giftedness, darkness and light. I now know that to be whole means to reject none of it, but to embrace all of it. Some may say that this embrace is narcissistic, an obsession with self at the expense of others, but that is not how I experience it. When I ignored my own truth on behalf of a distorted ego and ethic, I led a false life that caused others pain, for which I can only ask forgiveness. When I started attending to my own truth, more of that truth became available in my work and my relationships. I now know that anything one can do on behalf of true self is done ultimately in the service of others. Others may say that embracing one's wholeness is just fancy talk for permission to sin, but again, my experience is to the contrary. To embrace weakness, liability, and darkness as part of who I am gives that part less sway over me, because all it ever wanted was to be acknowledged as part of my whole self. At the same time, embracing one's wholeness makes life more demanding, because once you do that, you must live your whole life. One of the most painful discoveries I made in the midst of the dark woods of depression was that a part of me wanted to stay depressed. As long as I clung to this living death, life became easier. Little was expected of me, certainly not serving others. I had missed the deep meaning of a biblical teaching that I had always regarded as a no-brainer. I set before you life or death, blessing or curse. Therefore choose life. Deuteronomy 30:19. Why, I wondered, would God waste precious breath on saying something so obvious? I had failed to understand the perverse comfort we sometimes get from choosing death in life, exempting ourselves from the challenge of using our gifts, of living our lives in authentic relationship with others. I was finally able to say yes to life, a choice for which I am grateful beyond measure, though how I found that yes remains a mystery to me. At one fork in the long road back to wholeness, when I was in fact walking along a country road past a freshly plowed field, I found a poem taking form within me. I offer it, along with my unknowing, as a token of hope to anyone who may be enduring the harrowing of depression. Harrowing. The plow has savaged this sweet field. Misshapen clods of earth kicked up. Rocks and twisted roots exposed to view. Last year's growth demolished by the blade. I have plowed my life this way, turned over a whole history, looking for the roots of what went wrong, until my face is ravaged, furrowed, scarred. Enough. The job is done. Whatever's been uprooted, let it be seedbed for the growing that's to come. I plowed to unearth last year's reasons. The farmer plows to plant a greening season. Chapter 5. Leading from Within. Back to the world. From the depths of depression, I turn now to our shared vocation of leadership in the world of action. This may seem more like a leap than a turn, but none of the great wisdom traditions would look upon this segue with surprise. Go far enough on the inner journey, they all tell us, go past ego toward true self, and you end up not lost in narcissism, but returning to the world, bearing more gracefully the responsibilities that come with being human. Those words are more than a device to weave these chapters together. They are a faithful reflection of what happened to me once I passed through the valley of depression. At the end of that descent into darkness and isolation, I found myself re-engaged with community, better able to offer leadership to the causes I care about. Leadership is a concept we often resist. It seems immodest, even self-aggrandizing, to think of ourselves as leaders. But if it is true that we are made for community, then leadership is everyone's vocation, and it can be an evasion to insist that it is not. When we live in the close-knit ecosystem called community, everyone follows and everyone leads. Even I, a person who is unfit to be president of anything, who once galloped away from institutions on a high horse, have come to understand that for better or for worse, I lead by word and deed simply because I am here doing what I do. If you are also here doing what you do, then you also exercise leadership of some sort. But modesty is only one reason we resist the idea of leadership. Cynicism about our most visible leaders is another. In America, at least, our declining public life has bred too many self-serving leaders who seem lacking in ethics, compassion, and vision. But if we look again at the headlines, we will find leaders worthy of respect in places we often ignore. In South Africa, Latin America, and Eastern Europe, for example, places where people who have known great darkness have emerged to lead others toward the light. The words of one of those people, Václav Havel, playwright, dissident, prisoner, and now president of the Czech Republic, take us to the heart of what leadership means in settings both large and small. In 1990, A few months after Czechoslovakia freed itself from communist rule, Havel addressed a joint session of the U.S. Congress. "The communist type of totalitarian system has left both our nations, Czechs and Slovaks, a legacy of countless dead, an infinite spectrum of human suffering, profound economic decline, and, above all, enormous human humiliation. It has brought us horrors that fortunately you have never known." I think we Americans should confess that some in our country have known such horrors. "It has also given us something positive.